to the next page. You hold up ICUS, which is SEC Communications. Mr. Cook.
May it please the court. I will begin my argument with a point that was made at the end of our brief, and that is that the motion for summary judgment was filed on October 16th with an attached memo, a statement of uncontested facts, documents produced at discovery. Mrs. Leica's deposition had been taken on September 4, 2002. It had been quickly written up. She never waived signature. September 12th, it was written up, and it was included in the motion for summary judgment with the affidavits of Gladys Hammer, Mary Pat Husky, Pat Nellen. And then additional documents were referred to, which contained notations of other Ameritech employees, Nancy Hidalgo, Melissa Barrios, Lourdes Fitzgerald, Elizabeth Vanderwood. On December 17th, we served a notice of deposition requesting the opportunity to depose the employees that were named in the motion for summary judgment and requested all related documents. The deposition was noticed to December 27th. This is, of course, the Christmas time, so you had to kind of squeeze things in. 3 days later, we received a letter from the attorney for the defendants refusing to produce the employees and the documents based on the expiration of the discovery. There had been a discovery cutoff order on November 15th.
You only have, Mr. Cook, just a short period of time here.
Yes, sir.
And I'm going to ask you what I think is the problem with your case, and you tell me why it shouldn't be a problem. It seems like this is a very, just one job, one task that she was having a hard time doing. There was a lot of stress. She didn't like the job, and our cases have uniformly held that not being able to do one job or a small type of work in a narrow area doesn't make you a qualified individual with a disability under the ADA.
Now, well, Your Honor, this was the job that she knew. She'd been in this job for, I think, 17 years. She knew that work. She stayed with the job. She developed this.
Well, a lot of people stay in jobs they don't like.
I know, but she developed this.
They've been there a long time.
A lot of people stay in jobs they don't like, but a lot of people don't develop a severe depression as a result of the stress of that job. There's no question that this was a severe depression. The trial judge recognized the severity of depression. It's a very serious matter to the person involved. There was a question that was raised on the Mrs. the physician suggested that she worked part-time. That could have been handled, should have been handled by Ameritech. It could have been handled by having her work 2 days a week for 7 hours, or 3 days a week at different hours, or coming in later. All those things could have been done while she was checking on the results of the treatment which the doctor had prescribed. Now, there is in the cases...
Excuse me? What happened during her absence? She was gone for a period of time. Now, was that was...
But she...
It was determined that it was the stress on the job and that this was her problem. And when she was away from the job, she got a lot better.
Well, when she was away from the job, she got along better, but that was That was in the deposition that was taken 2.5 years later, that she was being able to function and all these.
Oh, you mean it wasn't?
When she was away from the job.
It wasn't, the testimony wasn't that she, that just being away 2 or 3 weeks was helpful.
No, she was away from the job with medication. She was getting along fairly well, and that was why the doctor was suggesting this part-time availability. And there is, under the cases, this duty to enter into the interactive process to try to work out something so that what can be achieved can be achieved. Meritech made no effort to do that. They knew, everyone in the place knew how difficult this had been. They knew of the depression. They knew of the severity. The trial court recognized that, and yet they did nothing. They simply decided that they were, because she had not complied with this rule that still seems strange to me, that she couldn't bring this note in from the doctor, because she couldn't do that because she was on discipline. But if she came in, she'd be fired. There was no way she could get this to him. That they well knew what the note said. They well knew what was in the record of the psychiatric clinic. They knew the Dr. Vora's opinion that this was a severe disability. All of this was known to them. But they just stopped. They said, well, we're not going to do anything further. And if she finds she can't come back, and she has certainly good reason to, I don't think I'd expect any member of my family to come back under those conditions with that kind of a mental illness. They do nothing. They don't want to even consider a reasonable accommodation. That's required by the cases. Get back to the case I was taking. I think, too, on that motion for summary judgment, there was a real question of denial of due process. Because when we presented the notice of deposition and they refused to produce the person, now, we had had no particular reason to conduct any more discovery. We had all the defendant's documents. We had our own documents. We knew we could put Mrs. Lelikas on the stand. We knew we could bring a doctor in to testify. We knew that if we identified the doctor, they would have the opportunity to depose him. All of those things. We didn't need more discovery. But then they filed a motion for summary judgment, and they list all these people, and we asked for some discovery, and we filed a motion with the court, and they filed the motion on January 3rd, fast as we can, and the court denies that motion. Now, I think that's a denial of due process. I think we're entitled, on the motion for summary judgment, my client was entitled to take those depositions and get to the facts, to ask for those documents. The fact that the discovery had closed, that was on a totally different issue. We now have the motion for summary judgment. We now have a motion which is raising jurisdictional points, which the court objected to. We filed a contested motion of fact. We contested a number of things. There are a number of contested facts throughout this. We should be protected in that situation. And when the court, trial court, I don't know whether they didn't think it through all the way, but certainly they bought an argument in there. They filed a reply on the 10th, I think it was. They filed a reply saying, well, there's nothing in the rules that would authorize opening the, extending the cutoff date to take a deposition. Well, you know, that's utter nonsense. In the real world, as the court likes to comment, in the real world, that deposition had to be taken. And when you don't let the person do it, you're denying their substantial rights. I guess that's probably all I should say. I'm near the end and I want to save a little time.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Caesar?
May it please the court. Respect to Mr. Cook, in his brief, he said that there were two issues before this court that he was raising in this appeal. One was whether Ms. Lelikas was substantially limited in the major life activity of working. The other was whether she was discharged based on that alleged disability. He did not raise any due process issues. He did not raise any notice issues. Those issues are not before this court. They were waived. Now, with respect to the issue that he did raise, which is whether she is substantially limited in the major life activity of working, the Supreme Court has ruled that plaintiffs in this situation have to provide evidence that they are significantly restricted with respect to a class of jobs or a broad range of jobs in various classes. As Mr. Cook acknowledges, there's no such evidence. The Supreme Court goes on to say that the inability to perform a single particular job is not sufficient to show a significant or substantial limitation on the major life activity of working. As a matter of fact, the regulations and the Supreme Court have shown how you go about proving this, and that is you look at the skills and education of the plaintiff, and you see the kinds of jobs that she could do given those skills and abilities, and she has to show that somehow her impairment prevents her from doing those jobs. And there's no such showing in this case. Even if she were disabled within the meaning of the ADA, she's not qualified to do the job by her own admission. She said in her deposition, prior to abandoning her job, that she had to pass every single call she received because she couldn't handle those calls. She admits that she cannot go back to work full time, and she admitted to me that she really has no proof that she could work part-time. She told her psychiatrist that she would rather commit suicide than go back to work at Ameritech. Nevertheless, in order to save her job, she asked her psychiatrist to write a note, and he did. But she acknowledges that she didn't know, and he didn't know, whether this would work at all. Mr. Cook, totally outside the record, said, well, she could work 6 hours a day, 7 hours a day. That's totally contrary to her testimony, which she said, maybe four, I don't know, the least they would give me, that's all I was looking for. This court has ruled that working part-time for a full-time job is not a reasonable accommodation.
Is that creating a new job, in effect? Would that be like making a new job or a separate job than the others? Or were there other part-time people?
There were other part-time people, Your Honor. And in terms of the way the ADA is laid out, I would say that being there, at least a substantial portion of your shift, is one of the essential functions. Not being there is not an accommodation. And especially in this kind of case where there's extensive evidence that you have to balance the number of operators with call volume, and it varies. Ms. Blalikas has presented no evidence that there's any other accommodation. She specifically said there's nothing else that Ameritech could have done. Moreover, even if she's not, or she is disabled, and even if she is qualified, she was legitimately discharged based upon her record of numerous violations of Ameritech's attendance policy. At the time she abandoned her job, she was on her fifth suspension for attendance violation, which was the highest level you could get to before discharge. And then she was specifically told, one more violation and you're out. She leaves on December 3rd, and looking at the record in a light most favorable to her, she informed her supervisor 3.5 months later that she had a release to go back to work part-time. Now, this court ruled in Byrne against Avon that the inability to work for a multi-month period removes the person from the class protected from the ADA. It's sort of a similar idea that not working is not an accommodation that allows you to perform the essential functions of the job, especially for 3.5 months. Moreover, even if she were to go back to work, she'd have to account for that 3.5 month period. So it's not a reasonable accommodation in terms of part-time work. You still have to account for your violation of the attendance policy. This court has said on numerous occasions that a second chance is not a reasonable accommodation. Finally, the district court should have dismissed the case under the full faith and credit statute. In the Supreme Court decision in Kramer, the court ruled that where a state court upholds the dismissal of a parallel state claim, it's irrelevant whether that court actually considered the merits of the case. The only pertinent question to this analysis is whether a state court judge faced with a new discrimination case based on the same facts would dismiss it based on the fact that it had already been litigated. The Illinois appellate court order in this case would clearly compel the dismissal of a discrimination claim in state court based on the same facts. Therefore, under Section 1738, the district court was bound to dismiss the complaint. So in conclusion, Ms. Lulikas was not a qualified person. She didn't have a disability. She had abandoned her job, and there's no protection under the ADA from that. There's no proof that she could perform the essential functions of her job. And what's more, she had the opportunity to litigate her case at the state level. She appealed the dismissal. She didn't make any arguments to the appellate court. And she cannot be allowed to ignore her failure and start from square one in federal court. For all of the above reasons, the decision of the district court should be affirmed.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Cook? You have 1 minute, Mr. Cook.
The first thing I should say is I don't know how you can waive due process. And the point we made was clearly made at the very end of our brief. The jurisdictional question was covered by the trial judge, and there was no cross appeal on that. I think they misapprehend what a major illness, a severe depression is. They're treating it as if it was some kind of an injury that you could recover from. I suggest the court and counsel has had the opportunity to look at the Humphrey case, which dealt with a woman who had a obsessive compulsive disorder. She was a skilled medical transcriptionist. She worked for 9 years at that. The disorder developed. She wanted to be able to do it at home. The court said in that case that it's a matter of law that there be a reasonable accommodation, that she was in fact disabled, this is a severe disability, and that in that case it was necessary to work out an accommodation with her, to work out working at home with the just as Ameritech here, the company there, the hospital there, did nothing. They didn't respond. They didn't make any accommodation, and the court reversed the summary judgment there, as it should here. I thank you.
Thank you. This case will be taken under advisement.